Blog Talk Radio.
That I could say. As Kwame Ture, formerly Stokely Carmichael, said, oppressed people have the right to speak their reality to liberation in their own words. Oppressed people have the right to fight against metaphysical imperialism. Tonight, Tuesday, September 29th, 2015, welcome to What's Happening, Ralph Pointer's Anatomy of Oppression. Anatomy of imperialism, anatomy of the forces that keep us apart, that keep us from attaining our freedom. If you want to call in tonight, please use 347-857-3293. I repeat, if you wish to call in tonight, please use 347-857-3293. I want to welcome all of our usual suspects, as they say. Round up the usual suspects. I want to welcome Brother Larry, Brother Minnelli, and Sister Lynn. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce our host for this evening, Ralph Pointer. What's happening?
Good evening, brothers and sisters, family. By all, and what I believe, the overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our laborers for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. Now, this program that we have been talking to you about is the Anatomy of Oppression. And that means, what does it look like? What are the parts that make it work? And we are going to continue the discussion of a funny thing happened on the way to the Colosseum, but what we're talking about is a funny thing happened on the way from trading companies to imperial power in a nation, a slaveocracy that calls itself a democracy, and the contradictions. Let me further explain. Our sister Betty Davis is an adjunct professor in a local university, a local college, and she teaches several classes. She teaches a class in philosophy, and a class in political science. I've been reminded it's the Dusty India Trading Company. We all know what that's about in America here. When the Europeans came here, this is the structure they set up to extract money from the Americas at the expense of everyone and everything in its way. We call them corporations today. But let me get back to the classes I attend with Miss Davis. I attended the political science, Poli Sci 1. And she explained to her students there are two things that we are going to learn about. And I hope this doesn't get her fired. But I guess after 51 years in academia, and maybe close to 52, maybe they will have to retire her because she refuses to retire herself because she says these students, these people, our people need to know the truth, and as long as she can tell it, she will. And let me get to how she talks about the opening statement. She says, we're going to learn about American government. We're going to learn about the documents involved in American government. But there are two sides. There is the piece of paper they talk about the American government, and then that is the real America. As I say, where the rubber meets the road, what we are dealing with in the continuation of the slaveocracy, this prison system, this housing problems, this imperial power that sends people to war and brings them back home and doesn't take care of them medically, their problems. And so, and we have in our usual suspects panel experts on what those papers said. Dick Minerly will talk about origins of these papers. What were their, what was their philosophy? What was their original papers? What was going on there? I'm told to stand in a certain place. Okay. What is this about? And then I like to talk about what does it really mean when it when we talk about somebody being killed, a black person, be a person of color being killed every 28 hours. We have Lynn Stewart, an expert on the law, one of the fine lawyers. I don't know what the noise is there. One of the fine lawyers of our country. So we have experts in various fields, but where the rubber meets the road is where I'm basically involved with or concerned with, because my feeling, and no, reality tells us that the law is a major instrument of oppression of people of color. Now, there is a law, and people can debate what it is. There is the Constitution. People can debate what it is. There is the nature of man. People can debate what it is. And personally, I don't go into all of that because as an old man, I don't have much time left. I want to get to the root of this evil and crush it out. And in order to do that, we have to have people to explain it to us. What happened there on the way from trading companies to imperial power that calls itself a democracy when it really is rooted in a slaveocracy and all of the evils that come with it. And so, without much ado, we're going to I'm going to introduce or have people come on, because where the rubber meets the road, we have political prisoners, people in jail who tried to make this place real. I remember I was watching a program, Al Jazeera, the other night, that's supposed to be a progressive, radical program. And Al Veshi, the commentator, was confronted when he was talking about Russia and the death of a lawyer, an accountant, who happened to be working for a hedge fund and made millions of dollars, and he was supposedly beaten in jail. And Al Vesci wanted to talk about, tell us about a prisoner in jail, who in a Russian jail, who was beaten, and so to death. And so the person who was talking to him says, I know all about it. I'm an expert on that. And when Al Vesci did his Donald Trump thing, he didn't want to talk about it. He did his loud thing. I call it the Jerry Springer thing. And when the person who was talking to him said, well, if you want to talk about people in prison, we don't have to go to Russia. If you want to talk about beatings and killing in prison, let's start with Rikers Island. We're here, right here in New York. He says, let's talk about American political prisoners. Of course, that was a bridge too far for Al Vesci, and he stumbled and mumbled, and it was an outrageous, pathetic performance he gave, but he was afraid to touch the idea of a political prisoner in an American prison. He wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. He ran, but he could not hide. It became obvious. And so without too much of hearing from Ralph, I'm going to switch, as we have a routine here. We have people who have much to say other than myself. So I'm going to switch it off to Larry Pinkney. Would you tell us what's happening where you are, Larry, and a report that you would like to give us, and information you would like to direct us toward. Larry, are you there?
I am indeed, my brother. My love and strength to you, of course, to Sister Lynn, that stalwart people's lawyer, and, of course, to the inimitable Sister Betty Davis. All power to the people. Thank you very, very much for having me. I want to be succinct and straight to the point. I read an article today that a friend in Mexico sent me, and the article, and I would encourage everyone to Google it. The name of the article is Obama has sold more arms globally than any president since World War II. Okay? Again, it's called Obama has sold more arms globally than any president since World War II. It can be found in the publication, which is entitled War in Context. Again, the publication's name is War in Context. We need to understand, and I've been saying this many, many years now, that we have to really link the dots. We need to connect the dots. The dots of imperialism, the dots of oppression, repression in this country can be seen not only in this country, not only in this nation, but all over the world. The U.S. Action, so-called police actions, military, brutal, hypocritical, deadly actions carried out currently, drone man Barack Obama and his minions, both Democrats and Republicans. These actions can be seen in Afghanistan, they can be seen in Somalia, they can be seen in Libya, they can be seen, well, it's in Iraq. You know, it's an endless list, as Gil Scott-Heron would say, that won't be missed. And we need to make that connection. When we talk about black lives mattering, and black lives do matter, indeed all lives matter, but if black lives don't matter to black people, come on, get real. And we, as a part of the human family, and I repeat, we as a part, an integral part of the human family, have an obligation to step up to the plate and stop just muttering things like black lives matter. I love the way that you put it, Ralph, that if they matter, and they do, then they have to matter to black people first and foremost. And unfortunately, my sisters and brothers, we have shown time and time again that they really don't. Having said that, I would like to bring people's attention to an article that I wrote in November of 2012. The name of the article is titled, Barack Obama and the New Plantation. Again, Barack Obama and the New Plantation. You can find it at the Black Activist Writers Guild. Google it, go to Black Activist Writers Guild and just put the name of the article in, or you might just be able to Google it. It's called Barack Obama and the New Plantation. And I began with a quote by Harriet Tubman, who said, quote, "I freed 1,000 slaves. I could have freed 1,000 more if only they knew they were slaves," unquote, Harriet Tubman. Today, in the 21st century, in the plantation that we are all on, or every, I shouldn't say we are all, because there's certainly an oligarchy that runs the plantation, is not on it. But we ordinary, everyday, struggling, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people are on this plantation. And we all have an obligation, in my opinion, humble as it may be, beginning with black people. How dare we say that black lives matter, and yet we sit down and salute destroying black, brown, red, yellow, and even white lives all over the world, including right here in the United States. So I'm going to end. I don't want to be long-winded. I hope that everyone will read the article from November of 2012, Barack Obama and the New Plantation. And I hope that people will read the article from the publication War in Context, the article entitled Obama Has Sold More Arms Globally Than Any President Since World War II. So much for the Nobel Peace Prize. So much for democracy. Because, as I said in an article that I wrote some years ago, and the article, I've referred to it before, the article is entitled The Hypocrisy of America's Democracy. And we experience this hypocrisy in its most brutal forms every single day in the United States of America. The hypocrisy of America's democracy. So I'm going to end here and urge that we remember, not just remember, but do something about our political prisoners. Yes. We have myriads of political prisoners, whether we're talking about Mumia Abdul-Jamal, whether we're talking about Leonard Peltier, whether we're talking about Brother Odinga, again, as Gil Scott-Heron would say, an endless list that won't be missed. We have to get rid of that list. Free our political prisoners, all of them. Bring them home now. They fought for us. It is time for us to fight for them and ourselves. Thank you so much, my brothers and sisters. Thank you. All power to the people.
Thank you so much, Larry, and say hello and great wishes and much love to your wonderful wife who frees you up to do this wonderful work that you do. And I'm going to call on Lynn Stewart to continue the reminder that we should not have to be reminded about, that is the political prisoners. And Lynn Stewart, are you there?
Hello, Ralph. Yes, indeed. And I just want to bring a report to everyone about what we have been doing in the last few days, the uplift of attending a conference with many young people dedicated, to bringing home political prisoners. This was a conference held by the NAABC, the Anarchist Black Cross Movement, and it was held in Denver, started out on the campus of a local university, where they had an open forum of all ex-prisoners, myself, Lynn Stewart included, and also including people from all segments of the movement. Eric McDavid was there, and our elder statesman, Mark Cook, who did over 30 years from Seattle. There was Kwasi Touré from Boston. There was Jahid Abdul-Mumit. And also, and I have to be forgiven for a senior moment, a young man whose name has been escaping me all day long, who served in the MCC New York for refusing to speak to a grand jury. If you want to hear these opening statements, and they were very well received by an audience of a couple of hundred people, and there were no glazing over, there was no people taking out their cell phones to check to see if they had messages. And this whole thing has been recorded, and you can listen to it on unicornriot.ninja. Not exactly my points of reference, but that is the name of the website that has recorded this particular opening part of this marvelous conference that lasted for the whole weekend. I repeat, unicornriot.ninja. Now, it moved from there to a Woodbine Ecological we were introduced to on behalf of the Kiowa Nation, who own the land and own it today, and reminded us that it once was Arapaho and Cheyenne land. This beautiful spot in the Rocky Mountains, we were happy to be in for the next few days. We had many, many events. Ralph and I both hosted anti-oppression workshops with breakout groups, talking about how we fight oppression inside and outside the jails, and with regard to dealing with political prisoners in particular. We also did a round table, that is everyone attending the conference, I would say, which was about 60, 70 strong, went around the room on Friday night, and each one said what work he or she was engaged on. And I tell you, if you ever wanted to be uplifted, this was the moment. All of these marvelous, marvelous young people doing all kinds of work, helping prisoners in Indiana who are under the death penalty, in Washington State fighting for juvenile justice, opening up no prisons for juveniles, only homes, open homes that have something to offer them. We had people who were from Tucson, people from Kansas City who are working on a case in which an inmate has been accused of mutiny because he refused to work. It was an uplifting moment, and when we heard all of the many things, many, many things going on, it made us so absolutely ecstatic to know it isn't in a morass. We're not just lecturing to the choir every week. We want to get out there and actually do the hard work to bring home political prisoners. I would be remiss if I did not mention Jihad Abdul-Mu'ayyad's presentation of Jericho's Initiative for a National Coalition for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This would be a national operation. We also spoke of other things that we hope will be coming true in the coming year, actions planned and follow-ups to those actions. It is not static out there, and I hope that everybody listening will stop arguing about how many Lenins can stand on the head of a pin or whether or not we're going in the correct direction or whether or not there is really any difference between Hillary and Trump and the black minister who wants to make sure no Muslim ever gets elected. We need to do the work to bring home the political prisoners. That is our prime. We must do that. And these young people at this marvelous conference, the ABC Black Anarchist Conference in Colorado, certainly made us understand that they are out there working and really serve as a challenge to all of us to get out there and do the same. They have radio stations. They have websites. They utilize the electronic world we live in today. And we oldsters, perhaps, have to take a page from their book and get out there, get in the prisons, talk to the prisoners, find out what's on their mind, and learn what to do next. Thank you very much, Ralph. It's a privilege to be on the show.
Well, thank you so very much, Lynn. And let me add that one of the things that happened out in the event was that we heard from our brother, Mark Cooper, what had happened to him as a youth. And Lynn had mentioned the years he spent in jail. And he is dedicated to make sure, to work, to make sure that what happened to him, the injustices that were visited upon his person, shall not be visited upon other young people. It was an outrage. He stunned everybody. He brought the room, and I'm talking about, I won't say hardened, but people who understood, who had been in jail. It was a new low for America, but we have to understand, as so many people like to deny, America has political prisoners, and the history of America has not been told. And many people, when I was teaching, we had many people in the black community who opposed us writing the books or introducing the books of black slavery, the black history, because remember, this is a new thing. And I say there is no such thing as black history. There is only history. And what has happened here, what has happened here to black people by black people, what has happened to black people by white people, what has happened to black people by the institution of slavery, Jim Crow, continuation of Jim Crow, etc. And as I was talking to Lynn during this period, I says, do you know, in my experience, every black family that I know and have related to, now let me say it once more time, every black family that I know and I related to has a story that was passed down from generation to generation about what happened in slavery times. And I remember upon first meeting Lynn Stewart, and when she became a lawyer, I said to her, one of the things that I may want you to do is to research, and this may be a touchy subject, but I think it must be raised, my first wife talking about how her family was run out of Mississippi as a young woman. She remembered her brother handing her out the window as the white Mississippi, I don't know what you would call them, after having threatened her father about getting out of town and leaving his land, and when they didn't get out fast enough, how they were burning one side of the house, and her older brother was passing her out the window on the other side of the house, and how they were fortunate in that these killers, stealer of land, allowed them to live as they walked out of the Mississippi bottom. And we were reading the story of home, and, you know, help me out here, Lynn.
Toni Morrison.
Novel of Toni Morrison of Home. And she writes so well. And I says, well, it's a novel, but it represents every black family or nearly every black family in America, the torture, the terrible things that were said. And let me get back to the point.
Okay, Ralph,
I
just want... Ralph, I'd like to just add
yes.
that if anybody out there would be interested in supporting Mark Cook's work for zero juvenile jails, Mark is an ex-Black Panther. Anybody there can Google him, and you will see what he was about and how he was in and out of jail for 40 years, part of the George Jackson Brigade. He is a true, true revolutionary, and his work is carried on in Seattle, Washington. You can reach Mark at markec@q.com. Please, if you're interested in supporting that kind of work, if you think that juveniles are treated with torture, and they are, please contact Mark. I'm sure he would be overjoyed. Thank you, Ralph.
Yes, as I started to say, as I have this habit of being circular, I go all around, and I like to come back to the issue that I started to talk about. And what I started to talk about was the issue of people, the mistreatment of people of color, and the people not knowing, and the teachers, the black teachers, the teachers of color who were in the system in 1965, who were opposed to teaching of black history because they said it was too cruel for children to hear and children to learn. I tell you, it is very cruel, the things that have happened to us, but we must be willing to learn it and do something about it. And so without further ado, I see someone else who is on the line.
Ralph,
there.
Can I have some further ado first? This is Lynn Still. I say to you that the story of blacks in America is not complete unless every child knows that history, just as every Jewish child knows about the Holocaust, and indeed every American child has learned about the Holocaust over and over again. Until the African Holocaust and the African-American Holocaust is as familiar to us as Dachau and Belsen, our history is sadly lacking. Thanks.
Thanks again, Lynn. And without further from Ralph, I would like to go to Richie. Richie, are you there? Who is, I believe, he's
yes,
a member.
Yes, I'm here,
of,
Ralph.
Can
you hear me?
Black. Rich, I can hear you, Rich. Tell us
how
where
are you
are broadcasting from. And as I was always said to Rich, he gets together at the Theater 80 on St. Mark's Place sometimes to have a quiet space to talk about what's happening. Richie, tell us what's going on.
How you doing, Ralph? We look for you in the parade in Harlem at the African Day Parade, but we couldn't find you or Lynn.
Oh, we
were
in the
you.
Parade. And one of the happiest moments in the parade was with Betty, who taught at PS 175 on 135th in Lenox, and Lynn was in the car, and people recognized us and waved us on and cheered and talked about political prisoners. It was a happy moment, and we were in a van because, you know, we're older. Betty and I, just a few short years ago, marched with the banner to free Lynn in the African American Day Parade. But as I say, we're very old. We're a few years older, and we had planned to stop and let Lynn get out and walk from 125th to 135th. But we had spent so much time in the car waiting for the parade to start. When we got to 125th Street, Lynn says, "I don't think I can do it." But she leaned out the window, and they interviewed Betty at 125th Street, and she gave a great interview about what we were about. And Betty, would you like to tell us what you shouted out? Well, we are an African people, and we are still here, and we are still fighting for our justice. And so, yes, we were there, wouldn't miss it for all the tea in China. And so, yes, Richie, sorry we missed you, but we will see you in coming events. But give us more about what you're doing and what's happening.
Yeah, I wanted to update you and read you some letters or some part of a letter I got from a political prisoner.
Please
and
do so.
About the assassination of Hugo Pinel, which is still... has to be addressed.
Please, go ahead.
If people don't know in the audience, I'm working with the shutdown. We're going to shut down New York City in October. In my job, I'm working to get the political prisoners aware of this. So I'm inviting you and Ralph, you and Lynn to bring your car back to the shutdown. We have a date, a place, Saturday, October 24th, 11 a.m. We're working on permits at Washington Square Park, and we have meetings every Sunday till the weekend. And we're inviting 100 families who have family members killed by the police are coming. We are flying them in. We're getting them here. I'm housing somebody for shutdown. And I'm working to get the African-American community involved, the political prisoner involved. We want you and Linda to come. And Pam Africa has endorsed it. And you should tell the audience you have endorsed it. So we're looking to have you come again, and I wanted to just read one paragraph of a letter from my anarchist Carmen, who has endorsed it, from Texas Chicano political prisoner, anarchist political prisoner, Luna Hernandez. They gave him 50 years. He took a gun away from a sheriff who tried to kill him. He just put the gun down, and they gave him 50 years. And he made a beautiful tribute to Hugo Pinnell. And he asked people to read this. He sent this to me in the mail. And what I'm trying to do is coordinate nationwide for everybody to come to New York to be part of this. So I invite the person you talked about in Seattle to come and talk about this. We are looking for sponsors. We are trying to raise money. And I'm going to a meeting every week, and I have some dates for Theater 80 in October, the 14th and the 21st, and every Sunday, where I want to do an event for political prisoners and have the families, New York families, have members killed by the police to come and meet the New York political prisoner families. So I'd like to read... if I have time, just one or two statements from one political prisoner and the other one. Because one is a Reverend Sister Joy Powell, who had an all-white jury and was put in jail, and they are stealing her mail. There's a guard who has tried to rape her. They are stealing her mail. She had to send me a letter back, certified mail. And she even sent me a birthday letter. I turned 52 on September 9th. So we're going to celebrate my birthday, Ralph. I have a whole bunch of papers. You need a lawyer. I need a lawyer and Lynn to look at to help this lady. She sent me stuff about what happened to her. But let me just read one or two sentences about Hugo Pinnell. And I'll read the Sister Joy, and we need people to start coming every week. I am in charge of helping get the political prisoner part of this thing involved in this. And Cindy Sheen is coming. She's going to be here all 3 days. So we'll make sure that you have an open invitation, Ralph, and Sister Rand and Sister Betty. And you're going to have a voice, and I'm making sure of it. And I'm going to make sure political prisoners are going to have a voice in this event. So let me just read this for the audience, and I hope to get your reaction. Power to the people, exclamation point. Power to our fallen comrade, Brother Hugo Yogi Bear Pinnell, exclamation point. We are saddened with the news that Yogi has been murdered last Wednesday, which is August 12th, during an alleged prison riot, which is a cover-up to cover up the murder, by two neo-Nazis who killed him at a Sacramento maximum security prison after Yogi's recent release from decades in solitary confinement in a California prison system. Our prison movement, as well as our outside social movement, grieves at the loss of one of the most respected and beloved foot soldiers within the belly of this fascist beast in our mutual struggles against the common enemy of the human species. The systems of colonialism, neocolonialism, capitalism, imperialism, and fascism. Although I never personally met Comrade Yogi through his letters, writings, and actual deeds, as one of the San Quentin Six and close confidant of Comrade George Jackson, also murdered by the state of California on August 21st, 1971, during the takeover and liberation of the Adjustment Center Control Unit in San Quentin Prison, I met Yogi in revolutionary spirit, as we were then, as we are now, continuing to build on national prison movement to educate, re-educate the entire prisoner class that we are all victims of social injustice, of the racist criminal injustice system, and to expose the true nature of capitalism. And he also writes, and I'll just give one other thing from Sister Reverend Joel Powell. He says that decades in isolation and solitary confinement, torture, supermax, control units, prisons, that's where he was in until he got out and then was murdered by two neo-Nazis. He was set up by prison guards for murder, either by prison pigs themselves or allowing other racist, violent criminal elements from within to commit this heinous criminal act. So the prison system can then attempt to wash its bloody hands of its murderous deeds. The fact that hours after Comrade Yogi's death, California prison guards and other racist reactionary elements got on social media to rejoice at the murder of Yogi, vicious nature of the state and its stooges. And I'd like to read just two sentences or two from Sister Reverend Joel Powell, morally convicted, anti-violent racist Reverend Joel Powell. She's at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility. I am a 21st century slave who refuse to get raped with my mouth closed. How dare I put the RPD on blast and demand justice rather than acquaintance to acquaintance to state-sponsored witch hunts and blatant murder of unarmed people of color, including the mentally ill, while in custody of RPD. When I realized that most of the so-called local actors were just doing the talk, their 15 minutes of fame by way of the media, and once the cameras are no longer there, I felt alone with a community of youth, which were in my anti-violence program and a few Muslim brothers. We're not even of the same faith, but were down for the cause. I began to step up to the plate and address the real underlying issues of the inequalities of education, misinformed suffering from social economic development, and police brutality. That's when I got an early taste of the insidious forms of overt and covert racism. I realized that what is considered the American dream for people of other color is the American nightmare of many people of color. And I just wanted to read one thing she says, that there is a prison guard that is attempting to rape her in this prison. And they said, I had a staged cell search on 5/6/15, wherein the officers claim they found a can tape under my bed. I was taken to solitary confinement, and all of my legal papers were confiscated. The lock was not about a weapon, but at all, because the administration knows that I am nonviolent. My legal property was a weapon, because when you are more apt to putting pen to paper than a lock in a sock, you will automatically become a target. Not only that, last year, April 5th, 2014, I had another staged cell search. After reporting being sexually harassed by a Sergeant Taborino, I was sentenced to 6 months in solitary confinement last year and 9 months this time. In both instances, I appealed the determinations to the New York State Commissioner of Corrections, who affirmed it. So now I will take the DOCCS to court. And she enclosed a whole bunch of stuff about her whole life. And this is what has to stop. We don't have any real law schools. We don't have a lot of Lynn Stewart's left. And these young lawyers are not helping me with my housing situation. Now, there are exceptions, but these housing lawyer schools are factories for the fake left. And we have to remember, the MOU bombing was done by a black Democrat, who then became a black preacher. And they said, oh, we can't have a white racist Democrat bomb move. Let the black guy do it. So we have to know where these Uncle Toms, Uncle Negroes, and I'll leave one last thing about John Africa. And I want to show this film at Theater Rady about his life. And I'll just say one thing and I'll shut up about John Africa. A lot of people don't know about him. His real name was Vincent Leppard, born on July 26, 1931 in West Philadelphia. At when he was tested, his IQ, they claimed, was 84. Tested again 8 years later, age 15. His score fell to 79. Transferred to a special school where Slow rated his overall performance as unsatisfactory, he had been deemed retarded. But this man was in the Korean War and then came back and understood what America is really about. And then it goes into how a social worker, a black sellout social worker, became an informant pretending to be to help John Africa. Instead, he made up charges, gave it to the police, and they used him to go against John Africa. So I just wanted to get that in there to say, there is going to be a major rally in October. So everybody has time to get to New York. And we like you and Lynn to be part of it. We like you to bring your car. And we meet every Sunday. And I'm working on this every day. As of now, I'm writing letters now to people. But what they're doing, I'll leave you with this, is they are stealing these letters I'm writing to political prisoners. We have no lawyers. They're trying to say... Okay, I just want to
one more
this.
Thing I'd ask the, you to do.
Sure,
the
go ahead,
woman man. At Bedford Hills, give her address again, and I'd like to remind
absolutely.
People of a woman at Bedford Hills that the movement has seemingly forgot, and that's Judy Clark,
thank
one
you.
Of the finest among us. But give us the address of the woman
absolutely.
You were talking about.
Please, people need to write to our political prisoners. Her address is Reverend Joy Powell, P-O-W-E-L-L. The address is, her number is, because they won't get the letters unless you put the number on the letter. Her number is number 07-G-0632. Bedford Hills, B-E-D-F-O-R-D, Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, Post Office Box 1000, Bedford Hills, New York, 10507-2499. She was tried by an all-white jury. The state provided no evidence and no witnesses. She was not allowed to discuss her activism or say she was a pastor. Furthermore, the judge, Francis Affronte, promised he was going to give her a harsh sentence because he did not like her. She was convicted and given 16 years and 7 years concurrently. So that's it.
All right, Richie. Thank you so much for that. And we're going to have to switch at this moment where we started at the beginning of the program to go to Dick Minerly, who's going to tell us about the paperwork of the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and what is the basis of the papers we honor. I have another person who's looking to go to the line for a few minutes, and I'm going to ask quick. That's 927-772 to give Mr. Minerly time to give us information history. Are you there, 7672? Are you there, 7672? You're showing on the board, but if you wish not to talk, it's okay. Dick, proceed. Go ahead, Dick. Are you there? Hello.
I just realized that in my comments about how James Madison had given us a very incomplete Bill of Rights when he wrote it originally in 1791. And I said that he had a good example because in 1776 he was part of a convention led by Governor George Mason, who wrote the Great Virginia Declaration of Rights, and he could have done a better job. I failed to give you an exact example, though, to show you the kind of deliberate intent behind the policy of Washington, Hamilton, and Madison to maintain a corrupt rightist constitution and political system. But I wrote this out. I had, by the way, reactivated my of my blog that has several articles that might be of interest to you. I just put on it an article of conception versus birth with my arguments for, you know, for the pro-abortion, the pro-choice factions. And I think it's a very compelling new argument. And all of this is available on my blog site, which is newideaspost.blogspot.com. And I have several articles there, and what I'm about to read you comes from that. At the moment, I've posted articles called Conception versus Birth on Gun Control, Rethinking Gun Control, The Consideration Cycle, a brief comment on my psychologic system, and Theism versus Realism. That's what I'm doing now. I'm going to add other things as the week goes on and so on. So let me just get to this point about what George Mason wrote as his declaration on the issue of arming the citizenry and how that compared with what was actually written by James Madison in our Constitution. Let me read from my text. Mention of militia and our right is point to the Second Amendment as if our Constitution were an unimprovable sacred text. Conventionally, a militia means any body of citizen soldiers or non-professionals. It might be an organized military force under the direction of a government, but it can also be an unorganized force that has no offices or regulated exercises, with soldiers who are unknown to each other until the time comes to be comrades in justice and the noble defenders of human rights. This latter view of a militia was stated clearly in the great Virginia Declaration of Rights, written by the progressive George Mason and ratified on June 12, 1776, by a legislative convention in Richmond, attended also by the liberal James Madison, the foxy opportunist who in 1791 used it as his guide to write the weakened provisions of the so-called Bill of Rights in our Constitution. Madison participated actively in this convention, which ratified Mason's declaration 3 weeks before Jefferson wrote the Colonies' Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia. George Mason said this, quote, 13, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. That standing armies in time of peace should be avoided as dangerous to liberty, and that in all cases the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. This, and not the 1791 National Bill of Rights that Madison wrote reluctantly, is what the true revolutionists in America understood to be, quote, the right to bear arms. Madison knew that the centralized state that he and his elitist co-conspirators favored would die quickly unless some concessions to the people on individual rights were immediately added to the new Constitution. That elitist Constitution was not written or ratified as the public wished, but rather was decided by Washington, Hamilton, and Madison. But the people and the great revolutionary leftists who spoke eloquently for them wanted a greater decentralization of political authority to the states and localities and a prohibition against a standing army in time of peace. But the rightist Federalists were determined to block both of those democratic demands. So Madison emasculated the Virginia Declaration. And as regards its 13th article, he wrote this instead, which we're all familiar with, quote, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Note that he intentionally discarded the prohibition against standing armies and then distorted Mason's clear definition of what a militia is. That is, he never mentioned that it was, quote, the body of the people trained to arms, as Mason did, but said instead, quote, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. But that added clause is just a blind truism that sidesteps the issue, which is whether our defensive militia should be considered A, a standing army controlled by the central state, or B, the body of the people trained to arms. The autarkic federalists wanted a standing army under their centralized control in order to defend their wealth and status and to humble the citizenry to that end, as the British monarchy did before them. And that is exactly what most of the people then, those who wanted a true democracy, feared. Rightists ever since the Federalists have continued to vitiate our individual rights and to further expand federal authority at the expense of the people and their communities. For some years now, elitist Democrats have united behind elitist Republicans like the conservatives Nixon, Bush, and Ashcroft in their blatant attempt to give us a fascist Department of Justice, an intolerant judiciary, a standing mercenary army to impose its will upon us and the world, and to make the subjugation of the people easier and unarmed citizenry. Note that the liberal Hitler disarmed the people in Germany as soon as he assumed power, for this is the first step in the old rightist textbook on how to transform an electoral democracy into a dictatorship. I will not join Madison in calling this, quote, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. I call it the right of the individual to have reasonable means of self-defense. As a progressive, I also reject the elitist assumption that this right to adequate self-defense is a civil right that can be granted or denied by any government. Instead, on universal moral grounds, I say that self-defense is a natural and inalienable right of all individuals and that it takes precedence over any of a state's artificial rules. The only open issue is what reasonable means, since even in a practice, even a universal human right is subject to reason. But surely it cannot mean anything less than that which a state's police or military forces might use, legally or not, to control its own people. If it did mean less, then both a people's militia and individual self-defense will be prohibited, whereupon democracy and justice are lost. And then I reminded you, or I remind everyone, of the poster that I got from Alternate U, where some artist did a nice job with this slogan. As the radical Huey Newton said truly in the 60s, quote, an unarmed people are slaves or are subject to slavery at any given moment. And that's all I had to say on that subject. You can go to my blog site and read the entire article. That's newideaspost.blogspot.com. The other thing I wanted to comment on very briefly, I'm wondering if it isn't natural for the our campaigns for political prisoners to be accompanied by strong statements against capital punishment, like as a part and promise, you know, parcel of that whole cause. Also, I'd like to say to Lynn, who mentioned the Holocaust before, that I have often offended some of my Jewish friends, and I have many of them, by refusing to accept the use of the word Holocaust to mean what the Nazis did to the Jewish people. I have some comments on that, too, in my book, but that's another matter. To me, there have been many Holocausts. There were many Holocausts in that whole area, 12 million people killed in the Soviet Union, millions and millions killed in Africa, and so on. So I don't use the word as a meaning as any particular action. A Holocaust is a Holocaust, and we've had a great many of them. So we're still having them. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Dick. As I was saying, as we opened up in the class that Professor Davis teaches, she teaches the two sides. And I do believe that Mr. Minnelli, I hope that Eddie will invite him to class to talk about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, not only as a theoretical piece, but when he says the right to self-defense is very important. And Joel, I know you're on, but we're running out of time. And if you want to come in for a quickie to give us something of what you're going to give us next week to start off the program. Are you there, Joel? Are you there?
Yes, hi. Yes, hello.
Yes,
Joel
I'm here.
I heard the tail end of that because unfortunately I have to work tonight, and so I got on to the phone a little bit late. But I just wanted to say it. Maybe I'm repeating something that had been said, but we should consider the Second Amendment really to be the First Amendment, because without the Second Amendment, without people taking up armed struggle, there wouldn't be any of those amendments or a constitution or an independent country from the British monarchy. When they Republic with its Bill of Rights was actually begun with the defense of the people in battles such as Lexington and Concord, which paved the way for there being any people's power at all. So,
well, thank you
those
for
other
that,
amendments.
Joel.
Yes.
And we will take that from starting from that point next week. We'll continue with this. Mary, you there?
I am here, Ralph. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for a wonderful program tonight. They let me in just as Mr. Menderly was speaking. I really enjoyed his reading, and also I heard part of the man right before Mr. Menderly, and I really have sympathy for that political prisoner he spoke about, because I am a political prisoner in my own home. They tore up my computer again today, as I worked with some workmen in my home. They want to excommunicate me from the world. You can look at my Google Plus page. That's Mary Loves Justice at Google Plus. My last post was about rape. I am being raped. And also, please look at my Facebook page, Mary Loves Justice at Facebook. So the situation is that you don't have to be in jail to be a political prisoner. I am a political prisoner while I am at home. They sent armed prowlers to my house 2 weeks ago, armed prowlers, a woman with a rifle, a man with a pistol. My little granddaughter ran into them at my house. I live in Georgia. So please pray for me. I have a lady that I will talk to you about next week. Her name is Vivian. Her son is in jail right now for a double homicide. He killed his uncle. They accused him of killing his uncle and another man. And the truth is that this young man is mentally ill. His mother had taken him, and he was willing to go get treatment.
Mary?
And their treatment was denied.
This next